Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by Wihau Ottobeisheim School of Management, powered by PwC, on the transformation of companies and their culture, from decision makers for decision makers, or from entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs.
Dear listeners, welcome to a new edition of our WHU podcast, Leading Corporate Transformation, powered by PwC. My name is Martin Klaum. I'm a professor at the WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management. And as always in this podcast, with me is Gori von Hirschhausen from PwC. Gori.
Thank you, Martin. And a warm welcome also from my side. Hello, everyone. Gori von Hirschhausen is my name. I'm the transformation consultant in this round. I lead the cross-industry transformation practice of PwC. So that basically means everything outside of public services and financial services. So, and it is a great pleasure for me today because we are at the Beiersdorf headquarters and we have Astrid Herrmann with us. She's the CFO of Beiersdorf, and we are very, very pleased to have you here, Astrid. And I'm sure many of our listeners know, of course, Beiersdorf and might also have heard about you. But nevertheless, it would be very cool if you could give a short intro to you and to Beiersdorf.
Thank you, and welcome here in our headquarters. Great to have you here. So my name, Astrid Herrmann. I've been with Beiersdorf now for 5 years. Responsible group CFO, but not only for the finance function, also for our legal and IT function. So working very closely with our CIO and head of legal as well. And you know a bit about the company, I'm assuming. We do have two, we call them business segments, but divisions you could call them as well. One is the consumer side with very iconic brands such as Nivea, Eucerin, Aquaphor, Hansaplast. I could continue. And then we have our industrial part, the Tesa business, which also has a little consumer business, but a much, much larger industrial business where we sell tapes that are in most smartphones, in many different other applications, automotive and so on. Our company has been around for a long time, 1882, and we're obviously quite proud of what it's been achieved to date.
I think it would be interesting to have a little glimpse at that history. I was amazed. I mean, I have to say, and Beiersdorf is a name one knows, all these brand names, one knows them. I knew that Nivea was quite, you know, I think it's called a heritage brand, right? Quite old and had its 100th birthday some time ago. But I wasn't, I was amazed when I looked it up that other products of the company are actually yet older. Right? I think the company started with Hansaplast and... another thing that I found out wasn't known to me was that Labello is actually a brand that is older than Nivea still.
That is true. So company was founded by an apothecary, and he founded or made the first plaster. And that's where it really came from. And actually, even our Tesa business comes from there, from essentially the glue
used in
the plaster. So absolutely. And yes, Labello, actually, this company created the first cream emulsion that really was sold to consumers. It created the first lip balm. Yeah. It created so many first products that then, you know, became standards, you know, in the industry. Actually, our dermatological brands were the first dermatological brands existing. Eucerin, based on Eucerit, which is this very, I'll call it fatty, a substance that you can put on your your skin for healing. It's all coming from this company. So it has a long history. Maybe one other little fact about the company history that is quite important also to where we've landed is we did lose rights to our brands in almost all the countries outside of, I'll call them the core European countries. And even there, we lost the rights to many brands and we bought them back over 50 years following World War II. Mm. And the last actually company affiliate we bought back was Poland in 1997. So the company spent a lot of time, maybe versus other companies, buying its own brands back and not new brands. But I think that's a really interesting part of you know, the history as well. The management teams for a really long time were very committed to that.
Indeed. I find, as I said, looking at this, I find that fascinating. When I think about intangibles and I'm teaching, you know, the reporting and accounting for intangibles, I think of research on the one hand and brands on the other hand as being quite distinct. But in your company, it comes together very strongly, right? And to think about that, something like Nivea is based on real, you know, research in these days and finding out the first stable cream. That was it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's true. And this is our heritage. This is also how we, in many parts of the world where they do not know very well Beiersdorf and they do not know very well our history, we do sell this German science. You know, you know German engineering from many different companies, but it's also with us the same way. We don't have what some French competitor have, the wonderful mineral water that they use in their creams. We actually have real stuff that works based on, you know, the R&D that we do here on the grounds.
Fascinating.
That's a perfect segue to maybe deep dive into the consumer division more. Because if we say Nivea, as you said, is a well-known brand around the globe, that's one part of the story. But there's also Derma, there is the La Prairie business. Can you speak a little bit about these three different categories?
Yes. So look, we go from mass, and it's not just Nivea. We have in our mass business that you would find in all the stores, all the normal, you know, Edekas and so on around the world. But then we also have our dermatological business, which in many parts of the world are still sold in pharmacies or other stores like that. And then we do have the luxury part of the business. And actually with La Prairie, we have the most expensive cream there is. Our most expensive line is about 2,000 euros for a little jar.
Jesus.
It is miracle. It has lots of things in it.
Amazing.
Yes, and the average basket of a consumer is really somewhere around 600 euros. So it's quite quite an expensive brand. But we're trying to grow this part of the portfolio too. Right now, luxury is going through a little bit of turbulent time because I think, you know, the consumer confidence is not quite at the level we've seen in the past. But over the long time, luxury has been a very well-developing part of our skincare business and just globally a great market. So we want to continue to grow that brand, that part of the business, which is why we also bought a new brand not too long ago, Chantecaille, a few years ago. And that's also been part of our heritage now.
You said that before that Derma is, of course, at the moment is outperforming from a growth perspective, the other segments. Can you speak a little bit about the importance of this, this specific product or this product line and what makes it so special? And how do you look at the mass market, the dermatological business and the luxury business from a CFO perspective?
Yeah. So look, they're all very important parts of our business. The mass part of the business, I'll start there for just a minute. It is the largest part of our business. Significant. Obviously also significant because Nivea is so big. Yeah. It is really truly the biggest brand in skincare and thereby also a really large part of our business. Almost too large. You know, Nivea really has to work. Yeah. Otherwise, it's quite difficult to you know, offset any pain there. The dermatological part, and we've just looked actually yesterday because there was a very important presentation actually in this room we're in, two parts of our supervisory board, but we've really tripled our derma business over the last, since 2016, we've tripled the business.
Tripled.
It's really become now a core pillar of our business. It's highly profitable. It has the highest gross margins we have in the business. And it has a very nice also profitability at the bottom. But beyond that, it's just this growth trajectory and the anchoring of our R&D in all those products. We typically launch new innovation, for example, our Thiamidol against pigmentation, so dark spots, pigmentation spots from, you know, hormones and everything. We launch in derma because there we have a chance to actually speak to dermatologists and explain them the science.
Okay.
Same we did last year with Epicilline, our anti-aging ingredient. We launched it in Eucerin because that's where we have a chance to really explain also what is in our what is the science behind our products? Whereas it's much harder to do in our mass business, where you have 15 seconds to explain, you know, a product to the consumer in an ad online or on TV, on TikTok, it's even 6 seconds. You can pretty much not explain anything outside of showing some nice pictures. So that's really what we use to anchor all of our innovation. Mm-hmm. And then again, the luxury part of the business, which historically has been, again, also a real growth driver.
Yeah.
The business has grown significantly, especially, I'll say it, to COVID.
Mm-hmm.
The times 2015 through 2019 were amazing growth periods for a luxury business, as also the Chinese consumer traveled a lot, had a lot more disposable income. We were really feeling that. And the profitability, as you can imagine, is also very nice on our luxury business, very high gross margin. But also a pretty significant fixed cost. All those beauty advisors in stores, we pay for them. A lot of our, you know, beautiful locations, we have to pay for them. So in difficult times, the fixed costs are not so good.
True.
In really good times, a lot of it falls to the bottom line, whatever you earn on top. So that's kind of a bit our business model too.
Yeah, I want to come back to a point we talked on just a moment ago. The combination of what you explained, technology, sort of, and R&D, and then brand and brand recognition and brand, you know, the transportation of this knowledge to the customer, how you do that. Yeah. And you're in the middle in somewhere. You're also in there as the CFO, looking at that with numbers. I find that fascinating how that goes. Because to me, I'm absolutely not a marketing man, but I know that understanding advertising, for instance, and the impact of advertising and how it works and how, you know, it functions, it's really difficult to measure. So how do you as a CFO look at that process?
Yeah, and it's gotten significantly more difficult to measure in the last, I'll call it 10 years, because of the advent, obviously, of one, the internet, but then
more
even
channels
recently,
and all that,
social media. There used to be a lot of transparency when I grew up. You know, and I worked in marketing controlling, and it was never called like that in the US. We don't use the word controlling to call functions that. But, when we were looking at our marketing spend, it was quite easy. You had a share of market, share of voice report. Mm-hmm. You could really track independently. There were agencies that would track the spend that would know what our competitors are doing. What are we doing? Where do we need to maybe increase, decrease? What sort of returns were we getting? It was simple. That's much, much harder to track nowadays, just because it's so dispersed. There's no one agency that's able to really comprehend in the end what everyone is doing. So you're much more in the blind, and you do have to find ways to measure your own impact, but you don't always know what others are doing and how do you need to react to that. So it's a much, much harder field. And what's gotten even more difficult in the last, let's say, since the advent of social media, is you constantly have to check, is it having the intended consequence? And if not, you have to change quite quickly. We call this precision marketing. Mm-hmm. You cannot just do an ad for, 3 months and then see what happens. Yeah. It's every day. What's the weather out? How do I need to react to that? What should I show? The person's looking for this. What do I then serve them? So it's much, much different than it used to be in the past. It's a lot more complex and it's much more difficult to react than it used to be.
So when you say you have to constantly check, that means with your own numbers. Your own numbers.
Or with our agency. We work obviously very closely with our agency partners, both on, to be honest, traditional media, but also on the new media. And we need to work with them and constantly make sure that in the end they adapt for us or we adapt for ourselves to make sure that the consumer sees the right message.
To put things into perspective, can you give a percentage of within maybe the two divisions, how much marketing or advertising the budget is and how much R&D is relative to revenue?
Oh, R&D obviously is a much, much lower percentage. Mm-hmm. We are in the range of where our competition is too, at around 3.2%. of our annual net sales goes into R&D. We continue to, it's the one area that we say when we think about our fixed cost that we want to have grow at the same pace as our top line. The rest of the cost we try to be a bit more frugal about, not about the strategic investments, but certainly the remainder of overhead. But in R&D, we want to invest. And similarly, on the advertising side, we call it marketing budget. We absolutely want to make sure that we are around 26 to 27% of advertising spend. So quite significant, much lower on the TESA side, about 2%. Mm-hmm. Because the consumer business is so low, but on the on our side of the business, the big part of it, it is a very high spend. And within that, just to describe, it used to be not too long ago, maybe 10 years ago, 100% TV or some print, you know, some things like that. And now it's 70% online digital. So it's very, very significant, and which makes it also so difficult to track.
If you look at this from a competitor perspective, what does it mean for your competitor landscape? If is this also changing based on this?
Very significantly. So it used to be much harder, much higher hurdles to get into the market because you had to spend big money on TV and so on to even, you know, be visible to your consumer. You had to, oftentimes it was much, much harder to get into the retail space to be able to display your product. Nowadays, those hurdles are very, very low. You know it, founder-led companies that come up with some sort of cream developed in some sort of laboratory or with a 3PM that produces it. You get online as long as you have enough people that listen to your story. You know, it's quite easy to do that. So local brands, as well as these, I'll call them founder-led brands, have continued to rise quite significantly.
Okay.
And certainly they're part of some of the challenges that we are seeing. We're growing, but, you know, these brands are taking up a lot of space. Absolutely.
And can you say this happens more in certain regions in the world? Is it more in Asia? Because something that I learned from my wife basically is how important also Korean cosmetics are these days. So is it also that you can locate these new competition coming from Asia more?
So it used to be less or more concentrated, let's say, on the Western side of the world, North America, but it is as you describe. It's everywhere.
Okay.
And particularly the Korean brands, that is true, are getting a lot of publicity. They are real experts in skincare. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of research. There's a lot of innovation that comes out of Korea. And it's spread around the world. So absolutely, yes. And it's now a global phenomenon. You find, you know, local brands, new local brands, you know, pretty much everywhere. Indonesia, India, Africa, everywhere. So there is a lot of coming and going.
Yes.
A lot of those brands do not make money, I would suggest. Many of them don't survive the 5 years. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, they are a bit of a pain.
Yeah.
And we need to find our own ways, obviously, competing with those. I think we do very well, obviously, on the dermatological side because we bring so much to the party. We've done also really well with Nivea the last few years. But in the last year, as markets have also really slowed, I think we're seeing an impact on consumer confidence versus the years before that is having a bit of an impact. We are seeing some pressure there. And certainly the local brands are gaining more.
Interesting.
They are oftentimes also cheaper.
Yeah.
So that might also make a difference in consumers' pockets.
Mm-hmm.
We obviously are really concerned about ensuring the right quality for our products and the right, you know, ingredients and
which is an important differentiating factor, right? If you can keep this, and especially in the dermatological business, it's so important, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. We obviously pride ourselves on that, that the consumer in the end, our long-term consumers know what's in our products.
Yeah. So I would like to come back to the different important world markets in just a moment, but would like to touch before we go there on the recent developments. You mentioned Nivea especially has had a tremendous growth story over the, let's say, previous years,
mm-hmm.
With I think double-digit growth and then some years. Wonderful.
Absolutely.
But more recently, it's more sobering, right? I don't know whether it's actually negative, but the growth is certainly not there anymore right now. What's behind that? Is it, you know, the consumer not wanting to spend anymore because of uncertainties in the world? But I mean, we had them also 3, 4, 5 years ago, right? These uncertainties. So what's different in 2025?
Yeah, that's a good question. What we do know, we don't have all the answers, unfortunately. Okay. But what we do know is that markets truly have slowed. Mm-hmm. And for example, emerging markets, unheard of, really where we see the markets in the latter part, you know, even negative volumes, which is really, again, unheard of. This is market. This is not Nivea performance. As you say, Nivea is still growing, not where we want it to be for sure, but growing. But it's really the markets that have declined significantly. In the end, I think what we are seeing as the one bigger differentiator certainly is the geopolitical uncertainty. Mm-hmm. How much in the end, I think the uncertainty of what's happening, tariffs here, there, you know, all the wars, to be honest, are having an impact on how the consumer chooses to spend money. And we are seeing our very robust over many, many years. So when I came as a CFO, I even looked at to see what happened during the recession, the financial crisis, you know, what did we see there? Extremely robust categories, and they are feeling a bit of a challenge today. And I wonder if it's related to that, that consumers saying, okay, these are now after quite a few years where they have spent a lot of money, whether they are now holding back a bit on a bit of more discretionary category. That said, I do think over the long term, you know, consumers are really into how they feel about themselves, their skin, how they look, and so on. I can only imagine that this is more of a short-term trend and that we should be able to return to better times too.
So I looked at the numbers. Actually, I looked at the numbers for 24 because the 25 numbers are still, you know, we're in the period where they are probably prepared in your office right now, I suppose.
Indeed. Yeah.
Germany is still a very strong market, right?
It's our number one market.
It's the number one market. Okay. And you still invest also quite strongly in Germany, we've seen. Right? There's a new plant in, I think, in Leipzig, is that correct? And also an innovation center here in Hamburg. And I'm impressed. I think we're all impressed about the campus here that you have here in Hamburg.
Lovely. Yes, it's great place.
So Beiersdorf is strong on Germany still? Because we hear a lot, you know, in the media practically every day now that Germany, you know, no growth and too cost is too high and the future is uncertain. But you are still investing here?
Yes, we are. I mean, one, it's because this is the ground where our heritage was created. And in the end, if you are about, I'll call it German scientific development, you kind of have to be here as well. That says we are investing in other parts of the world. So we have a big innovation center here, but we have also innovation hubs in other parts, in New Jersey, in Sao Paulo, in China. In terms of our manufacturing footprint, given that we do have still a very large European footprint and a relatively easy way to, for example, also ship to Africa and so on from here, that this was a good location to build. The Leipzig plant is highly automated. So it's a huge plant with a lot of, you know, in the end, technical lines that do a lot themselves. We need to do that too, because, you know, also there's not that many workers around in Germany. So we need to manage that quite well. But it is a really good location. So we really did a study to say, where should we place a plant like that? And that location came to be quite high in the ranking.
At the same time, you have a real global footprint, right? And your CEO just stated how important India is. That's a top priority for Beiersdorf. What makes India such a compelling story?
Well, beyond the one point, I don't know, is it 6 million?
Of course, the size, yes, so, sure.
Lots of consumers.
Yeah.
Also, long heritage. Funny enough, my first visit for Beiersdorf to India, I was picked up by a cab driver. Yeah. And then I said to that, he asked me where, you know, where I'm from and who I work for. And I said, Beiersdorf. And then I realized Beiersdorf, that means something to people here in Germany, but not to others. So I said, oh, you know, I work for the company that makes Nivea. And then he said, but that's an Indian company. There's no way you could work for an Indian company. And then I explained that that's not the case, but it's been around so long in India, first with the distributor and only recently in the early 2000s with our own affiliate. And it's done an amazing journey since. And we really see it as a huge growth market for us. It's where we want to invest, where we want to grow. The Indian consumer, as you know, continues to grow in their own disposable income. And certainly our categories are accessible and a perfect way to also grow our business while obviously getting new consumers to buy into our great brands that they also know already. We expanded also, we launched Eucerin in that market as well. So that's going very well. And even our luxury brands. So absolutely, it's a great.
So you have all three categories, basically.
We have them all three. Obviously, as you can imagine, the derma and luxury only recent 2 years that we've launched them, and they're still quite small business comparatively, but absolutely growing well.
Interesting.
So let's look at the other big, big, big market in Asia, China, right? Relatively the same number of people and for many, many companies in Germany, one of the most important markets, also one of the most difficult markets nowadays, right? Because what we hear from a lot of companies is that, you know, the local competition is now very, very strong. Chinese companies are innovating and in some markets are even leading technologically. I mean, is that a phenomenon you also notice that within your area, the competencies have, you know, improved in China and then you get a lot of local competition from there?
Yeah, it's a bit different depending on the business. So we see less of that in luxury. In luxury, I would suggest it's still one where the Chinese consumer aspires to buy, you know, the big luxury brands. That said, they are spending less because they feel, I think, less confident about their future at the minute. So Chinese consumers certainly are holding back their purse a bit in terms of luxury, but they still tend to look for the big luxury brands. But in the remainder of the business, mass and also even dermatological brands, absolutely. There's been an amazing amount of local innovation in China. Companies that are very fast, very agile. I don't know if they make money because they do so much, invest so much. They spend a lot of money online in China. The large part of the market is all online. It's a very small, in the end, market in stores and a huge amount of spending behind all of these brands. But yes, they're proliferating very, very fast. And they do come with really good packaging innovation, really fancy looking, but also ingredient innovation. So yes, it's certainly kind of replicating what's happening in the rest of the world as well.
Interesting. The US, we talked about it. Very, very big. You invested specifically in some brands that are local brands, Coppertone, for instance, I think. However, it's, you know, it's in the news every day, regulatory uncertainty, tariffs. How does it affect you? Are you affected by that? Would you consider even moving production over there to avoid, you know, tariffs, things like that?
So we have very, very limited impact in the US from tariffs so far, which is the good news. We import very little from Europe to the US. The bulk of our US sold products are produced either in Mexico or in the US itself. So that's quite limited impact, which is very good. We consider the US, or I consider the US, to be honest, our most important market.
Well, it's the second largest. Kind of your home market in a way, right?
True, true.
Yes. We'll come to that later.
But beyond that, it's our second largest, the country right after Germany. A few millions. It will overtake Germany, I think, quite soon. It's double the size it was just a few years ago. So the performance has been fantastic. We have iconic brands in that market. It is still a market that grows much more robustly than any other I'll call it developed markets. So it's a fantastic place to be. We have, again, really strong brands there. We have good plants. I truly believe that that is the market that we need to crack. We need to double it again in a really short period of time. Absolutely. Let's hope that USMCA stands, because we do rely on a lot of Mexican production. And if that changes, there's ongoing negotiations that obviously could have a negative impact. Let's see.
So Mary, we talked a lot about consumers, the consumers division, which is by far the largest, of course. But now maybe let's switch gears and let's turn our eyes on Tesa. You are on the supervisory board of Tesa. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the business model and a little bit of on about the current trends that you see in the market, and how important is Tesa, and how does this fit together with your consumer business?
Yeah, we get asked that question all the time. And as you can imagine, some analysts would suggest it doesn't belong to our company.
Yep.
But to be honest, Tesa is not a diversification play by Beiersdorf, as in they bought Tesa. It's truly made by this company.
Yeah.
It's part of the foundation of this company. It's not something we acquired. We have some synergies. I would not overplay those, but in the back office, IT, things of that nature, we do benefit. Some contracts we buy together and so on. But in the end, it's part of the heritage of this company. And yes, I am on the supervisory board, so I actually work quite closely with the Tesa team. In fact, this morning, my first call was with the chairman of Tesa.
Okay.
And it's a great business. It's done quite well. It really catapulted, to be honest, the industrial part of the business when quite a few years ago, it decided to much more closely work with the electronics, big electronics player, including the one on the West Coast in the US. We're not allowed to use their name, but they really even have an office in their office where they develop things together.
Oh, wow.
And that's really catapulted Tesa, making, really small tapes that look fantastic on glass. You cannot see it compared to maybe liquid tape that you might see a dispersion. That's really what's, and now it's pretty much in almost all electronics. It is a hard business. Every year we have to regain that business. So we constantly have to innovate at Tesa. We constantly have to find new ways to make it slimmer, to make it more holding, and so on. One big topic is debonding. The big manufacturers also want to be able to recycle, to contribute to, in the end, our climate and recycle parts. And so take it, gluing it, but then also taking it apart and being able to recycle is a big topic. And then the whole area of e-mobility. So we've invested quite a bit behind also helping the car manufacturers create lighter cars, tape batteries for fire protection, do all these kind of things. And those two areas, actually, the real core of our modern Tesa business.
Yeah, very interesting.
Absolutely.
Structurally, the consumer business is much larger, right?
Much larger,
I don't
yes.
know, 7-8 times or something like that, right? And again, as a structure, the Tesa business is completely separate, I understand, right?
Yes.
So that's how it works.
Because they used to be here with us, so not far away in our old campus, and then kind of grew out of that and moved to Norderstedt. It's not too far away. Again, there are collaborations on some parts, but it is truly a separate stand on its own business.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm sure you do get these questions from analysts, right?
Absolutely, yes.
That's the normal thing. So let's take a look now to the finance domain, right? To your
Let's
home
go
domain,
there. Yeah.
And maybe we start with the stock market. And looking at that, I couldn't help but see that about 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, the stock price was at 140 something, almost 150 euros, I think, and now it's down quite a lot. Roughly a third of that has gone. So what's behind that, and what do you tell investors to regain confidence, I guess, or to look into the future with confidence?
Yeah. So look, I think the really great performance of the many years before that, or the 4 or 5 years before that, obviously contributed to a doubling almost of the share price, to be honest, not quite, but a really strong performance for, let's say, some 80 euros up to the height you mentioned. But to be honest, the analysts and the investor community are a bit spooked by the trends that they're seeing. And in the end, we were hoping at the beginning of last year, we did not see the market slow down as much as they did. We had given other guidance, and then unfortunately, you know, mid-year, and then even in the third quarter, we had to revise that guidance. And you know how that goes. Setting the right expectations and meeting those are kind of, you know, the most important things you can do when managing a publicly traded company. And that was difficult. So, and again, it was not having that visibility. We had seen things like that before. For example, in 2024, first half, the US business was very soft. The markets were very soft, but then they rebounded quite quickly. And what we were seeing last year is just this much more global phenomenon of the markets really, really slowing down. And that's what, you know, in the end surprised us. If you look at some of, you know, our competition has gone through similar challenges. And I think that spooked a bit the investors. They're worried about the trends they're seeing. You know, in the end, the only way you can turn that around, obviously, by delivering better figures. It's also a mixed performance as well. I think that's important to talk about. You know, when you look at our 9 months results, we still had a very strong derma business, a very strong healthcare business, but certainly Nivea not growing as fast is not helping.
So my understanding is that you focus on two things: one, on growth areas like the derma business, but also on improving margins. Right. There's a specific program we saw, Win with Care, that you're pursuing. Can you elaborate on that? How you do that to, you know, improve your operational efficiency?
Sure. So look, I mean, we did give ourselves with our new strategy a you know, charge to deliver on profitability. We had given a goal of plus 50 basis points, and we made that a couple years in a row, really in the end growing through a few areas. Innovation, very clearly, but not just, also white spots. We really expanded into countries and thereby really grew the top line. And in the end, our margin significantly helped by a very strong mix, a much stronger growth of our skincare business, which is more profitable, and much stronger growth in the end of our derma business, which is much more profitable. We really had a big impact from positive from mix. Also from pricing, we have to acknowledge we did take quite a bit of pricing, obviously also to compensate costs. So that was, you know, more of a play to offset, but our mix really significantly improved. And then what we tried to do is make sure that we really managed our overheads very well. If you're looking at our overheads, a percent of sales, they've really come down very nicely while we've invested in the strategic areas, you know, maybe digitalization, e-commerce, digital media, and so on. We really wanted to make sure that we are doing the right things for our business, but at the same time, control over our overheads. And that mixture has really contributed to us delivering on the bottom line performance. And that is our goal too. We want profitable growth. So we want to emphasize both. Growth is important.
Yeah.
We see it again and again that the market really, really cares about growth. But that combination of driving profitable growth is important. That said, we always said this as well. We have a long-term perspective. You're going to ask me anyhow about our, our major shareholder, and they certainly have a long-term perspective. And we do not want to make short-term wrong decisions that in the end are not the right thing for our brands.
So looking at this, this means that especially you as a CFO and your performance management is of high relevance at the moment. Can you speak a little bit about how you do performance management at Beiersdorf?
Obviously, we have our key, you know, indicators, and we look at that monthly with our teams. We have our cycles where we look at it in a bit more detail, our forecasts and our budgets. We work very, very closely with the regions. We are set up in regions. We have an emerging markets region, a European, North America, and our luxury business. We work very, very closely. I think nowadays, just to be in kind of your rigid process is not good enough.
Yeah.
I think since the COVID time, we've had to be much, much more flexible and really be at the pulse of the business and also make more short-term decisions, to be honest, of how we need to shift the business. So it's really this close collaboration in the end, looking what's the right thing to do for us as a company. It's really required us to have a lot of visibility.
Yeah.
We've invested a lot behind our reporting to make sure that we have a lot of good data. And again, that we can more quickly have scenarios together on what's it looking like now. We started the year, first week of January, already talking about, instead of just working on the close, already talking about, well, where do we see now the year 2026? And so we need to be able to do that. We need to be able to take what the business is giving us and using that to, you know, drive different decisions. Absolutely.
Do you have advanced analytics in place? Do you use newer or latest technology to explore where you are? And do you develop new KPIs around the? Because I think, as you said, profitable growth is the key target. And this means to manage around the globe with all your different markets. This is a very complex task, I guess. And so my question is, how much technology helps you there and what kind of technology?
Yeah, so it does. So well, the good news is we, a few years back, we implemented S/4HANA and we have a really amazing foundation that is everywhere except for our luxury business. And we're working on that, but everywhere, the same one platform, which is really fantastic basis to build off. Quite a few years ago, we also introduced one reporting so that we also, again, look at the business in a certain way that's common and we talk about the same language. So we've really tried to build this foundation. And now, of course, we are using, you know, AI and other, you know, means to really look at our data and decipher what it's telling us. So absolutely, always trying to stay on top of, I think we need a lot more. So, you know, it's a never ending journey. We need to stay on top of that and continuing to invest in growing that. But we have, and we even have put together small teams, for example, in our Poznan hub that work on analytics that continuously kind of look at, okay, what, how can we develop that area for our business in order to make sure that we have the right insights for our business.
Oh. So you've just mentioned the reporting side of things. My recollection is that Beiersdorf has a very, shall I say, almost unique approach to that by having outsourced a lot of its reporting and doing that jointly with companies in India, if I recall it correctly. Is that correct?
Not reporting.
Not reporting.
Okay, then. But accounting.
Accounting, okay.
Yes, so we did, when I joined, we only had one shared service in Hamburg, of all places, which is not known as a shared service
not,
hub.
Not really.
But we had taken the first steps to take, I'll call it the very basic accounting to Genpact, our partner. And since then, also with the help of a fantastic leader for our shared service hub, which I only needed to unleash.
That's Axel, right?
Yes, exactly. him and our organization, because it's really also collaboration together with, you know, I think all the other finance leads. But even beyond that, these are cross-functional shared service hubs. We now have a truly global footprint. And yes, we're doing, again, continue to work with Genpact. They are a great partner on doing all of that. You know, I call it basic work and also developing that with us. It's not static. It's not the same as we were a few years back. And we continue to also automate there. But it's a good partnership that I think has brought us a lot.
Right. In order for that to work, the processes, I imagine, would have to have been very highly standardized and you know, otherwise this kind of collaboration with a partner and outsourcing to a third party doesn't work. Does that give you now the possibility to work a lot with the data because it's already standardized early on, and you have made your homework, so to speak, to apply AI and other advanced technologies with that?
Yeah, I mean, data, I feel like, is a never-ending story, and you always can be better, more disciplined, and so on around data. But it is true that Biostore really already, even before my time, I can't even take complete blame for that, but it really worked on having the same account structure and so on. So
yeah, exactly.
These basics, all these things, that really, really help, and really help when you give it to a partner, because the last thing you want to give to a partner is, you know, many different things that is too expensive, and the partner usually doesn't do the best job of streamlining it for you, although Genpact does work really closely with us on these topics. So that is a different foundation we have. That said, I shouldn't give the impression we still do a lot ourselves. So we have our own shared service. We have managers and teams that work on that, but then they also have, again, this basis of our partner Genpact below that. So and in our hubs, it's really our own employees as well. So it's a good mixture. From my previous company, we owned it all. The previous company's shared service was all internal. So I know that that can work. But this good mixture of both internal people as well as external people, I think, are quite a good formula as well.
I think another very, very important aspect of your job as a CFO is that Biostore is a publicly listed company, right? But the majority control, a bit more than 50% of the shares are held by the Hertz family, right? So my question would be, I do believe sometimes it can be tricky for a CFO to balance the interests of the family and the public shareholders. Can you speak a little bit about what does it mean to work in such an environment as a CFO?
Yeah. So look, after having spent my entire career previously at American companies, publicly listed American companies, that certainly have a certain aim, I think it's good to have this. You know, it does allow us a much more longer term perspective that I think is really helpful, especially in times like these, you know, where it's turbulent, where we don't have kind of a consistency of the business year in, year out. It's very important to have this backing of saying we do what's right for our brands, not just for this quarter or for this year, but for the longer period of time. And I think that's good. And the public part of it is good too, because they do critique us and they do give us a lot of good insights and challenge us. And I think trying to balance this, you know, I think is a good mixture. It's an advantage, I think.
Interesting. Yeah, as you describe it, I think that's a perfect structure because it combines these two different aspects.
So this is completely public knowledge. It's the Hertz family that owns a controlling stake in Biostore, just over 50%, something like that, I think, of the shares. How is the involvement? And they are invested through a vehicle called Max Invest, I think. How do they influence the strategy of the company and the financial strategies and basically then your work as a CFO directly?
Sure. I mean, you know, they're obviously members of the supervisory board of Biostore. Herr Hertz himself is a member of the Biostore, but is, you know, the chairman is obviously connected to the CFO of Max Invest is in our board. So they're quite close to us as a company. They're very interested. They're very collaborative with us. They're obviously very present also in our company, and through the supervisory board, obviously can influence all those important decisions we make, whether it's strategic investments and so on. It's a close collaboration, obviously, as you can imagine, as a CFO. And it's one about, you know, in the end, when I came building that trust that we can work together and that we have the right intent around what we do for the company. So it's a really important part. Yes, it is special because it's obviously one majority shareholder. But in the end, you know, you have to do that always with your supervisory board. Mm-hmm. You have to have a relationship where you can work with the supervisory board, where you can build trust. Transparency, I think, is extremely important. So I think, you know, yes, it's a little different, but it's same.
The setup, you share that with some other companies, big companies, especially in Germany also, that's not so unique. But I mean, it's a defining characteristic, I think, of a company like Beiersdorf. While I understand that it gives you stability and helps you, you know, pursuing a long-term strategy and orientation, isn't it also limiting in what you can do in terms of your financial, discretion, like when it comes to big investments that other companies might finance easily with another equity, issue, where here the equity structure probably is a given?
Mm-hmm. Look, in the end, we as a management team have to come with persuasive proposals. You know, I do believe in that, yeah. You know, in the end, that's our responsibility. And I think if we have those, you know, we've shown that we can persuade our supervisory board to go along with that, maybe big CapEx investments like mm-hmm. we've made over the last few years on building a few big plants or expanding those or even acquisitions. So I think it's absolutely doable, but it has to be, I think, the right plans for, to be honest, from a financial perspective, but even more important, strategic perspective for us as a company.
Yeah, very interesting. So as I said, I do believe this combination is very compelling because it gives you this long-term perspective while you, as you said, being challenged by capital markets, getting good insights from being listed, of course. So that's a very interesting way of doing it. We could talk from my perspective for hours about that. But looking at the time, let's switch to another topic. Let's switch to you as a person. Astrid, you started your career here in Germany at Alcatel, if I remember this correctly. But you moved early to the US and you have spent more than around 16 years with Colgate-Palmolive. Mm-hmm. So first question, what brought you to the US?
Well, that's funny. A little story just to tell, just a minute. But I went to America for a 6-week trip the day after my final exam from studying. I already had a job lined up for the 1st of September. And I thought I'm going to do a big trip to the US. And I wanted to see business schools because I wanted to do my MBA in America. And I did go and look at some business school. But on day 2, I met my husband.
Here we go.
And obviously he was not my husband then, but I decided to then not even a year later to, I worked for a whole year in my new job at Alcatel, but also continued to waitress. I did that my entire studies to save all the money I can so that I could then move to America. And I was lucky too. My boss at Alcatel gave me $1 with his name and phone number on there. And he said he thinks it's a great idea what I'm doing. And if I'm not successful, he will take me back. So that was
great.
Kind of very nice.
Very good attitude.
It was the best thing that happened to me, I think. I always say that because I landed in San Francisco in the heydays of Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
If you had any, you know, brain, you could get fantastic jobs and learn a lot. And it was a really, really good time. So I'm very grateful that I had that opportunity.
Right. So you spend a lot of time with American companies, the Clorox company first, and then Colgate-Palmolive. What have you learned there that helps you now? What are the big, you know, takeaways from these years? Altogether, it's what, more than 20 years or something? Or
it was
roughly 20
actually
years?
Even more than 24 years that 24 I worked years. For these two American companies. Yeah. That's true. So actually, I started working when I landed there. Typical German, maybe a little bit. But I, the minute I had my work permit, I applied at various companies. And I'm not exaggerating. Within a week, I had I don't know how many job offers. So it's really fantastic time. And I thought, you know, Bank of America was one of those. And I thought, you know, big bank and Swan, you know, this is the
strong
place
brand,
I will go.
Absolutely, yeah.
Very solid, you know, I will go there. And within a week, I knew this was not the place for me. I was one analyst on this floor with, I don't know, 200-300 analysts all sitting in front of a computer. And I thought, oh my God, this is not what I want. But luckily I could get a new job and I went to Clorox. And Clorox as well as Colgate are really strong financial companies. They have a certain management style. They have a certain way of including finance in everything they do. Mm-hmm. And I really learned what finance is all about there. Chloris even had a rotational program, but not as you think about it here, trainee program, but really every 15 to 18 months, you got a new job in your first part of your career, six years. Yeah. And you learned everything about the company. And that was just an amazing foundation for my career. Loved it.
So with this strong financial focus, as you describe it, so you've been a financial analyst, you progressed to become a finance manager, finance director, vice president of finance, and ultimately now you're a CFO. So was becoming CFO, was it already your plan?
I got that question a few times. No, not at all. Absolutely not. But what I did very early in my career decide is actually when I started at Clorox, my first bosses, not even just the first boss, but the first bosses were women finance directors. I didn't report directly to them. I was a lowly financial analyst, but you know, they were the finance directors of the units that I worked in. They were women. They had families. They were so good. I really wanted to be that right away. I pretty much knew that in a few months.
Yeah.
And that's what I worked towards. You know, I said, you know, okay, what do I need to do to get there? What experiences do I need to have? What parts of the business do I need to get into? And that was my, you know, way forward. And then from there, it was more, when I got asked, I always said, you know, as long as it's challenging me, I have more responsibility, a broader scope. That's what I want to do as long as I have fun. And that just continued.
Okay. Yeah.
That sounds fascinating. That sounds great. International career, responsibility is more and more and broader. And you have family, right? You have two kids and you have family. And you know, it seems, you know, almost unbelievable. But how do you do that? How do you manage that? Because I think that a lot of our listeners will look at such a career and think, you know, well, that sounds interesting. But, or, you know, how do I balance that with private life and with having a family?
Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned, it's a much more common thing in the U.S. Mm-hmm. To be honest, again, my mm-hmm. first finance, we talk about the 90s, you know, when I moved to the U.S. And it was a kind of normal thing already then there to be able to do that. And one, I think, because the companies, at least that I worked for, I can't judge for everyone, but they allowed you to. There was none part-time work. You cannot have a career in America with part-time work. That I don't mean at all. That's a very German way of approaching things. But it was more of a, you could leave at 6. You might need to go back to your computer at 9 o'clock when your kids are asleep. But there was a flexibility there that allowed you to manage it. It was hard work. And for a period of time, I truly did nothing other than my career and my kids. Friends were a little, you know, little, and even my husband, you know, unfortunately, it was only those two parts because I did want to do also justice to both. So it really was about my career and as much time as I could spend with the family. And I didn't miss out on things. It was also normal to say, I need to leave at 3 because I have to go to my kid's performance. That's completely accepted. Even then, accepted in America, just might mean at 9 o'clock, I still need to get my stuff done. So I think that is, you know, way of being able to manage that in the US. Beyond that, though, I did have the right partner. And I always tell that to young women, pick who you think you can do a life together. I think that's really, really important. And, you know, I think requiring your husband to be part of that is really, really important. And then another big factor that I give so much credit to is my parents. My parents, even though my dad is an entrepreneur, my mom worked for him, they immediately dropped everything. My mom would come and stay with me when budget periods were. Yeah. And, you know, or when I had some crazy stuff going on. She came once for almost an entire year when I did an executive program with Colgate. You know, she was there. They helped me do that. So I think it's also about how do you create an environment for yourself where it's not just about you, but it's about this community that helps you make it happen.
That's fascinating. On top of that, if I get it right, you also spend time, you just said you focused, right? But you spend also time on voluntary work, right? Outside your job, you mentored veterans, I think. You're working with school kids. And can you talk for just a moment about this also?
Sure.
And where you get the time for that in addition to everything else?
You know, this also, I'm sorry to say, the Americans have ahead of us.
Yeah, very true.
Clorox, from the beginning, the first time I volunteered was at Clorox. We went to the soup kitchen in San Francisco in the Tenderloin and gave food to people. I've done that many, many times. And the first time I did a reading program in Oakland, in the school really close to the Clorox's headquarters, we went and we read with kids that came from a underprivileged background. In my lunch. So I gave up my lunch. I gave up the soup kitchen was on a Saturday. I gave up my weekend. But to be honest, it was already in that environment that from a very early time in my life, you know, it was kind of built in, expected, but also fun and a good way to do it. And I stuck with that. I always, participated in all those things that were given. Also because I feel like I benefited from a lot of things in my life where other people invested time and effort. So it's a really good thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Very interesting. So how you combine all of these different challenges and pursuits that you were following. So to learn even a little bit more about you, what we always try to take as one of the last questions is there something that is very inspiring to you? It can be a book, it can be a podcast, it can be even a TV show. Is there something where you say you take a lot out these days from?
Oh, okay. So you're asking me a little different. Before you gave me a heads up that you might ask about a book. And I have,
it could be a book. Yes, of course.
If you're asking this, I feel like
new perspective.
The world is so heavy. If you read news, it's so difficult.
True.
And then there is The Daily Show.
Yes.
With Jon Stewart.
Yes.
I listen to that. That's also a podcast version. Because obviously at nighttime, it gives me so much pleasure to listen to that. They are so smart about things, so perceptive about what's going on in the world. And they do it in such a funny way that it just gives me joy to listen to that and laugh every day, Monday through Thursday. It lightens my day. It is lovely to have a little bit of laughter in this gray and crazy world.
So humor is a key aspect.
It's so important. Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Very cool. Yeah. So listeners, to take this into consideration.
We had obviously primed Astrid to look for a book or to think of a book. We should also ask that then, right?
Please ask, Martin. Yeah, please ask.
I think we should, right? So,
sure.
What would be the book recommendation then?
So I love reading historical biographies or novels. I also like reading like hardcore history books, but they can also be boring. But novels where it's really more also the story behind everything are amazing. And Eric Larson, I don't know if you know him, but he writes great books. I read a few months ago his Churchill novel, The Splendid and the Vile. Fantastic, unbelievably good to really understand what it was like. You almost can live it, you know, what it was like during that time. But then also more recently, I read The Devil in the White City, and it's about the World Fair in Chicago and what that actually did to the city and really to the world also in terms of architecture and building cities and so on. And it's just fantastic. So I really recommend those two books.
That's super. Thank you so much. And Astrid, you must have a superb time management to get everything in, including reading the historical novels. This, as always, brings us to the end of this episode. I thank you so much for spending time with us. It's been truly, truly fun. I hope you listeners also enjoyed the episode, and I hope you stay tuned in for further episodes to come. Thank you very much.
Also from my side.
Thanks, Astrid. And let me just take one quote from Winston Churchill, because you dropped his name. So he liked to say, keep on bargaining, which is very important in these days today, right?
Absolutely.
So thanks, Astrid, for the great insights. And yeah, listeners, looking forward to have you tuned in next time. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
That was Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by Vihau Otto Beisheim School of Management, powered by PwC. Editorial team, Annika Lux-Rerich and Zeman Gerlach.